fix it light, the alert that my body's trying
Check
to give
engine.
me, the check engine. Yes. I clearly don't handle convenience. But with that small intestinal bacterial or microbial overgrowth, we do know that we talked about how prevalent IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, is. Now we want to talk about why it's that prevalent. So a lot of the times my patients come to me so frustrated and they're like, my provider diagnosed me with IBS, but didn't tell me why I have IBS. And again, it is something that is off in one of those three main parts. So with SIBO, that small intestinal bacterial or microbial overgrowth, because it could be outside of bacteria, fungi, something called archaea, we do know that that accounts for 14 to 70% of irritable bowel syndrome. So if you've been diagnosed with IBS, you really want to look into SIBO, IMO, SIFO, and really just try to understand, do I have this? Because we do know, again, that that can lead to those IBS symptoms. And there are many common causes of it: excessive antibiotic use, like I mentioned, food poisoning or post-infectious gastroenteritis, a prolonged low fiber, low antioxidant diet where those gut bugs are just starved, the healthy ones. We know hormonal imbalances, whether that's thyroid hormones, sex hormones, any other hormonal imbalance, chronic constipation. And that could be from any of those other things that I mentioned. Like I mentioned, pelvic floor dysfunction, dysfunction of the little valves or little doors that separate and compartmentalize the gastrointestinal tract. So many more. There could be many, many causes. And I even say SIBO is not a root cause diagnosis. So when someone comes to me and they are diagnosed with SIBO or we're identifying they have SIBO, we're still asking, why did you have this? Why do you have this? How did you get here? What's going
It's
on
even deeper.
in the structure, the function, the population? So we can say not all IBS is SIBO, but all SIBO is IBS. So again, if you've been told you have SIBO, you do have IBS. You do have irritable bowel syndrome. But we want to ask, why are you irritable bowel? What happened to you? What's going on? And with this condition, with it, specifically small intestinal microbial overgrowth, I tend to hear common things, and there are documented common symptoms. Very commonly, people will find, I wake up with a flat stomach, and once I start eating or drinking anything, once anything is interacting with my gut bugs, I start having progressive bloating to the point where by the end of the day, they might look and or feel 6 to 8 months pregnant. So the distension, which is the appearance, the bloat, which is the sensation, is excessive to the point where I have patients. I just had a patient yesterday. She said, I haven't left my house in 2 weeks. I'm having such a bad SIBO flare, and it was a perfect storm for her. I have patients who say, I can't wear pants. I haven't worn pants in 5 years. So they'll just wear dresses and flowy things because even a waistband of leggings is painful for them. So if you're having that cumulative excessive bloat that's causing that hypersensitivity of nerves, you might want to ask your care team to check in on this for you. They might find because of inflammation and opportunistic inflammatory bugs, they're having mucus or blood in their stool. That's always something you want to bring up to your care team because that should not be happening. That indicates there's a breakdown or excessive inflammation. They might have, again, malodorous gas. So ask yourself, does my gas have a strong smell? Really, if your gut is healthy and everything's in balance and harmony and good flow, your gas should not smell. So it should really smell like nothing. You should not smell the food that you've been eating. That means you're having malabsorption. It shouldn't smell like a petting zoo, an outhouse, or a cow. That indicates methane is present. It shouldn't smell like rotten eggs. So the smell can actually tell you about who's living in your gut, but you shouldn't have malodorous gas. You shouldn't have gas that's in excess of 15 to 20 times a day. And you shouldn't have trapped gas that you can just feel piling up and isn't passing. Really, you should have a healthy daily detox in your bowel movements, in the form of your bowel movements. It shouldn't come out with a strain and constipation. You shouldn't be skipping days, and it shouldn't be just spilling out of you to the point where you're seeing, oh, wow, I just ate that 8 hours ago and it's undigested in my stool. We should also not really be seeing that you're having spontaneous or uncomfortable belching that either is malodorous or feels like it was stuck or feels like you have to belch in order to alleviate some gas. Those can clue you into some of the signs of and symptoms that your body's saying, hey, something is off. And again, SIBO is not a root cause. So one of those three major components of the gut is off. And a lot of the times it is dysbiosis. So we do want to identify, do you have an overabundance of some of these bugs? Not all of these are unhealthy bugs. Some of them are just, they're common bugs. They live in the gut, but they can sometimes migrate up to places they don't belong. For example, with methane overgrowth, we're all going to produce methane. We've heard of methane mainly from cows, but if we're excessively constipated, these certain types of gut bugs are called archaea. They start eating that stool and they're like, hey, this is yummy. And they make gas called methane gas. And if there's an excessive enough amount or their dysfunction with the little door that separates your large intestine, your colon from your small intestine, guess what? They're going to go into your small intestine too and be like, all right, I had enough of eating that stool. Let me eat your food now. And they're going to make methane gas there in the small intestine. So that's usually what leads to that upper bloat and that upper distension. But commonly with methane overgrowth, you might experience constipation and then something called overflow diarrhea. So it's not necessarily that daily there's diarrhea. Usually with overflow diarrhea, it's the fact that you got so backed up, your body's desperate and it says, let me just draw in as much water as I can to the colon and just wash the stool out. Usually overflow diarrhea happens every 3 to 4 days. So for the most part, you're constipated. You might have overflow diarrhea once a week or twice a week. Very bloated. Again, smelly stool, smelly gas that smells like that outhouse, that petting zoo, that cow, and bowel movements could even be painful. So that could clue you in. I think I have a methane overgrowth, and then we can test for it too. You could have hydrogen overgrowth. So maybe you have excessive E. coli or Klebsiella, and that can usually result in diarrhea and excessive gas. It could be hydrogen sulfide, where you have different types of gut bugs, Dysalvivrio, Fusobacteria, a very wide variety of different bugs that can take sulfur. So you could be eating sulfur, taking sulfur supplements, and they're going to eat that up and make this type of rotten egg smelling gas. They cause a lot of sensitivity, inflammation, urgency. They can cause diarrhea or constipation. Or you could have an overgrowth of the microbes that are in the kind of fungi genus. So you could have yeast or mold, or any type of fungal overgrowth. So usually this comes with constipation, belching, pain right here underneath the ribs, indigestion, bloat. You could have things like oral thrush, that white coating on your tongue, white specks in your stool. So we want to identify who is living in your gut. And again, we can test for these in various ways. So we can do a breath test. That is the gold standard way of testing for small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. And with breath testing currently, you can test for methane, hydrogen, and hydrogen sulfide. We can't test for fungal overgrowth right now via breath. We do know stool testing is still developing. So we don't have a validated FDA-approved stool test just yet outside of things that look for basic parasites. But we are really coming along. So with the right practitioner, if they're trained in reading a functional stool test, that can also tell you, do you have overabundance of any of these bugs living in your colon? And then what did your small intestine tell us? What did breath testing tell us? What are your symptoms telling us? Because then that can help us identify who's living in the small and large intestine.
We're halfway. I want to everyone to take a nice deep breath. Take a nice belly breath because it is, as you can see, quite a lot of information and it's excellent information. It's needed information. And I want to point out something from the beginning of the connection. You see, not a lot of people realize our gut's creating gases. Isn't that crazy? Where are these gases going? They're going in our bloodstream. We exhale them. And it's amazing. That's another connection of the gut to the circulatory system, to our lungs. And it's really cool to see how this all interplays. And so, really, really exciting and fun to do. All right. I love it. And now we kind of shift a little bit as we go into the nutrition and the really cool nutrition aspect of SIBO. Yeah.
So if we're identifying you do have something going on, you do have those symptoms, we're identifying those bugs temporarily, yes, we could alter your diet. And we like to think of it as a reverse elimination diet because it's temporary eliminating something to eventually add it back and hopefully add it back in abundance, or at least add it back in some way, shape, or form. So we do know if you have one of these different conditions, you might actually benefit from certain medical nutrition therapy. So we see a low FODMAP diet, which is a low fermentable carbohydrate diet, where you could ferment those different sizes of carbohydrate chains, that could help with both hydrogen and methane overgrowth. So we do sometimes use that with our patients. We do find also if you have fungal overgrowth or you have very severe leaky gut intestinal hyperpermeability, you could benefit from a low histamine diet. So we're identifying, do you have histamine symptoms? How can we eat to treat? Do you have sulfur symptoms? Should we temporarily pull back from sulfur and then definitely try to add it back in after we've really worked with the gut a little bit? Because we know a long-term low sulfur diet, not great for the liver, our main detox organ, really the contractor, the foreman of the entire detoxification process. So temporarily, do we want to pull back on sulfur? Do we want to eat in a more a low fermentation way? Because that can be maybe a little bit more sustainable and more long term. So we do know it doesn't matter how slow you go with adding fiber, you do want to resolve to add it back in. So whether it is temporary, whether we do kind of make a long term plan for you because maybe you had very strong allergies or intolerances, the goal is eventually to retrain your gut to tolerate fiber. As you're getting out of gut debt, you do want to retrain your gut on how to balance that spending that it's doing.
And that is what's really special is over the many years of studying this and diving deep into this and then developing these protocols and identifying these various aspects of food and nutrition. That is essentially what Dahlia and Rachel and our really cool integrative dietitians do is work with patients to identify these diets, identify where it makes the most sense. And also, most important is not throwing out, like if you are on a low FODMAP diet, that sometimes doesn't mean you have to take out all things that are high FODMAP, right? So it's really individualizing this process. Another thing I want to touch on is the importance of the connection to IBD. We don't hear this enough. Dahlia mentioned it earlier, where the progression of this damage in your gut lining and this leakiness of the gut can progress to autoimmune disease and cancer. But typically, I mean, what's happening is IBD is a form of autoimmune disease, right? So those with IBD, we're talking about Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis most commonly, are experiencing a form of autoimmune disease. And in this really cool prospective study done on US government data, so it was on military data and military personnel seeing the doctor, and they were seeing the doctor, they focused on a section of those seeing the doctor for GI related symptoms and issues. And really interesting what they found. So they found about a 800 and 60% greater incidence of IBD among those with IBS symptoms. And that was compared to the control group. So if you're coming in with IBS symptoms and IBS-like conditions, you're seeing an 8.6 time increase or 860% increase in the likelihood of that turning into IBD, inflammatory bowel disease. In those who were diagnosed with IBS, they had well-defined IBS. Maybe it's been going on for multiple years. Some have IBS for multiple decades. They were 1,500% more likely to develop IBD at some point in their life. And so also those found with kind of that stomach flu, the food poisoning, or some of these more acute, those having those were at a twofold greater increase of then getting IBD. So again, we are telling a story of connection where it's not just, oh, I have a little constipation and diarrhea here and there. It's why is that? What is that? And we don't want that to progress. It could progress differently for everybody, as we saw in that spiral. It might come out in different areas of the body, but ultimately, we're seeing this increased risk for those of you with these symptoms. For those of you, whether it's your body's whispering, talking, or screaming, it will come through these bigger and bigger symptoms and bigger damage to the gut as time goes on. So we really want to take hold of that sooner rather than later.
And we do know studies also show, again, because inflammatory bowel disease is very serious gut dysbiosis. So studies even show 33, so a third of those, 33%, a third of those with inflammatory bowel disease who are in remission. So they're no longer experiencing symptoms, they're considered in remission, they no longer have ulcers or inflammation. They still tend to have IBS symptoms. So again, that really does show that it is that very significant progression. So even if you've reversed one step, you still want to continue working on the gut microbiome and still really addressing what are all the other factors that played into me developing IBD, and how can I continue to improve the structure, the function, the population, so that way I can reverse these things.
This is where we get to the good news, guys. There's hope. There is good news. I know it can seem a lot of symptoms and issues, and oh my gosh, the soil and pesticides and antibiotics. But what's really cool is that there's a way out of this, right? And there's a way to kind of heal with each meal. Who knew? Oh, interesting.